This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Shoad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han. Welcome to the morning run. And good morning.
And good morning to you too as well.
Did you sleep well,
Tan? I did, actually. Yes. It was very, very restful. And I think it's due to the tremendous support I'm getting from the team. So, yes, I get an extra hour of sleep. Yes.
That's a bit of flattery in the morning. Thank you so much for thanking us. Also, maybe it's the weather. It's inclement, but it also is perhaps a little cooler. Temperatures ranging between 25 and 30. It's cloudy with scattered showers, if you didn't know. It's not like Melbourne, one of those cities where the four seasons in a day.
Right?
Yeah. That's what they say, isn't it? So, because overnight, developments both in Britain over that terror attack, as well as the Philippines, where there was a terror attack, including, I think, a beheading of a police officer and many injured. Now, we heard initially that President Rodrigo Duterte is going to impose martial law on the island of Mindanao. The Marawi city where the attack happened is in Mindanao. He's now saying he's mulling nationwide martial law. And to make sense of this, we're going to be speaking to an academic based in Singapore about that, because it's going to have implications for the rest of the region. So we're speaking to Joseph Raymond. He's a research fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies.
And whether or not that threat of Islamic militants, or in Philippines' case, ISIS, whether that will continue to just ramp up, especially in the region. Even here in Malaysia, we had that one attack, albeit relatively unsuccessful. But nevertheless, it is very much at our doorstep. And perhaps how Rodrigo Duterte goes about trying to stem that threat can be a litmus test of sorts for how the rest of the region continues to contend with this rising threat of ISIS.
Right. So also in the mix this morning, we have on the Breakfast Grill Her Excellency Anne Motello. She's the High Commissioner of Namibia to Malaysia, and she's coming as representative of the African Union, all the African embassies and missions here. There's some 21 of them, I believe. African Day commemorates the establishment of the Organization of African Unity. I believe the theme this year is youth. And of course, the continent has a demographic, a surplus. It's got dividends on that level, where many continents and many major countries like China, Japan, actually have a demographic deficit. So these are one of the many questions I'm going to ask. Talk to her.
And there are 1.2 billion people on the African continent. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. This is why I googled it. In 2016, it was 1.2 billion people, because that compares to India's, I think, approximately the same amount of people, and China has many more people. So it's a huge landmass with perhaps a population that hasn't quite reached its potential. But I could be wrong, especially in terms of the geography. How much of the continent is habitable is also another question. We are going to be having also Ringgit and Cents this morning. Zoraida Ahmad, Senior Manager at RAM Credit Information, is coming on for that show. That's after the 9:30 bulletin. Now we have the Pixies and Here Comes Your Man, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Here Comes Your Man by the Pixies. I'm Shoad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han, and the morning run rolls on. Well, it stretches at least this part of the morning. I'm going to stretch you a little intellectually. According to some studies, it's a big mistake to base your self-worth on your professional achievements. I think in some places, I think in Malaysia, we often base our self-worth on not just professional achievements, our professional achievements in terms of salary. So, so it gets even more specific. Does that make sense? What other measures could you have?
Well, I think often you're seeing this shift in sentiment, or at least the definition of what success is, to include perhaps what makes you happy, finding meaning in other pursuits and not just measuring it in terms of dollars and cents, right? Or in our case, ringgit and cents.
But, is a psychologist telling us that our parents were wrong, that our aunties and uncles are wrong? Because aunties and uncles and parents have for, generations told us exactly what success, how to measure success.
And success only comes by way of you being a doctor, an engineer, a lawyer, accountant.
Accountant, I think so. Maybe. Yeah.
Well, at least the first three, I guess now with automation, accountants risk losing their relevance in the
Don't forget, there could be robo presenters on the horizon.
Yeah, no. I guess that's all of us. But I think nevertheless, I think it's important to understand that perhaps this is the extension of the definition of success rather than saying this is a zero-sum game. So it's no longer just dollars and cents. So it's I think it's a case of you can measure it in dollars and cents. You can measure it in your professional achievements and also family and happiness, experiences, etc., right?
Well, I wonder if this is a first world problem, right? In the sense that for the wisdom of those aunties and uncles and, parents of yore, is that with a professional success and a good salary, you achieve security. Mm. And financial material security brings peace and calm. I mean, at some level, right? I mean, if you get too much money, because then all kinds of other anxieties emerge, like being kidnapped and your personal security and people not loving you because of who you are, but because you have a huge bank balance.
And perhaps this is also a sign that perhaps material wealth isn't all that it's cracked up to be, because despite society in general here in Malaysia becoming more wealthy or wealthier, right? And then now we have to find new definitions for success. And so in other words, we are just an unsatisfied bunch. How do you satiate this notion that we have arrived, right? Like, I don't think that's such a thing. So perhaps these kind of comments from the psychologist saying we have to find or redefine the definition of success, is a symbol that we just can't get enough of a good thing.
Yeah, I think the other dimension of it is that in achieving success, professional success, what ought to be sacrificed? And I think the older generation perhaps had at its heart this idea of sacrifice. And, when I talk to people from a particular generation about their lives, and I talk to a lot of people who are migrant workers here, the kind of personal sacrifices they make, extraordinary. Han, I was in India recently, and I spoke to a man who told me about, he was much older than me, like say in his 70s, and he's talking about an uncle who he had in Singapore who would come back, and he got married, he went to Singapore to work, and in that time, after he was married initially, his wife was pregnant. When he came back, his first child was 5. He brought a lot of goodies back, and then he left again for another 5 years, which time his wife got pregnant again and with their second child. When he came back, the first child was 10, the second child was 5. And those extraordinary sacrifices you make for the good of the family. And I think that's something that cannot be underplayed when we look at how older generations define professional success.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, it's not to say that current parents and our contemporary parents do not involve a huge amount of sacrifice as well. Because I, for example, I have some students, and I kid you not, true story, yeah, I actually have parents of students who actually sold off their homes and then started renting a smaller apartment just so that their daughter, my student, could go get an education in the UK. So you have the kind of material sacrifices as well. Certainly, I mean, it is a changing world, but at the same time, the demands for success or what constitutes success, like I pointed out earlier, just continues to be somewhat beyond the reach, right? So we're constantly pushing the limit of what constitutes success. So, at the expense of just plenty of sacrifices, either material or time or emotional.
The emotional issue is interesting because for me, it's like, at what point should you stop making sacrifices, right? I mean, yes, we always celebrate those who make sacrifices, but sometimes it can also be disproportionate. And, and then you get all this twisted martyrdom kind of dynamics happening. I made sacrifices for you, so you now owe me your life and your choices. Are now also somehow my right to determine, right? I mean, that's the dynamic between parents and children, right? So parents make far too many sacrifices. They try to blackmail emotionally their children. And children similarly feel tremendous guilt. So you have all this slightly twisted relationships going on to the future.
So, I mean, perhaps the silver bullet is to be content? Is that what it is? Going back to the context that you outlined, right? We have come so far. Should we be okay with what we have right now?
We're going to go further on the morning run, Han, with Bob Marley and the Wailers. Something to put you in the mood for, maybe not for sacrifice, but for responding to your inner rhythms. This is Three Little Birds after these messages, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Bob Marley and the Wailers and Three Little Birds, one of my favorite tracks from the great reggae singer. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Tan Chung Han, and the morning continues. We look at two documentaries that I watched recently on Netflix, and
you've got a lot of downtime, my friend.
I do indeed. But, you know, even my downtime is work time. You know, it's kind of a strange thing. I just feel like I'm so industrious. Even when I'm lying almost horizontal on my living room couch. The two documentaries I want to alert you to, Get Roger Stone and Wiener. So these are two portraits of American politicians. And though I'm not particularly fascinated by American politics, I mean, I am in some sense, we're constantly being force-fed American media, and most of us willingly swallow. The question is, this is extraordinary. I was wondering, could we ever do a documentary like this in Malaysia where politicians, the people in the public limelight, actually, what do? They allow themselves to be vulnerable. They open themselves out to a real inspection of something beyond the surface, beyond what they want to project to the world.
And I wonder if that is it has its roots in narcissism, where they want, you know, that kind of fame and they want that kind of platform, and, you know, they are okay with being vulnerable. You know?
Absolutely. So there's one, in fact, say Roger Stone. Let's just a quick look at those documents. Roger Stone is a man who began his career with the Nixon campaign out in the 60s, 70s. He was actually very, very young. He just came out of university. He's only in his early 60s now. And he's become the kind of hatchet man for dirty politics in America. He's become synonymous with that. And he says he embraced it. He says, better to be infamous than not to be known at all. So this is one of those, what they call Stone, aphorisms, one of his sayings. And but Wiener, on the other hand, because it's Anthony Wiener, who was a congressman who was disgraced because of problems in his private life. I mean, he wasn't stealing from the public purse. He didn't misuse power. He didn't do all the things that we've become familiar with when it comes to politicians. It's really quite a personal foibles.
Yeah, that's putting it nicely. Yeah, I know he took some certain pictures of...
Don't say certain. Just go for it. Say it.
No, they're just pictures of his... Wiener.
this is it, right? So and of course he is married to Huma Abedin, and Huma Abedin, of course, was very close to Hillary Clinton. She was an aide, and it's kind of famous because it's a Jewish Muslim marriage, as it were, and all that. Like, for all those reasons, it was a very interesting power couple. But because of his personal foibles, he stepped down. But then he also then tried to run for mayor of New York City, and really failed in a spectacular way.
I think this is just a sign of the broader culture out there. If I may use this really, really broad brush to try and encapsulate the state of American culture, whereby, you know, it is not taboo, you know, whereby, you know, being able to expose yourself literally and figuratively, but perhaps more is not as frowned upon compared to a more traditional and conservative society like Malaysia, you know, and perhaps that may also explain the reason why they can churn out so many reality TV shows, and you got an endless stream of people who have got no qualms, you know, going out there and start very often making a fool out of themselves, you know, and, so that we can be entertained.
Yeah, okay, that's true. So, you know, Roger Stone says is that politics is entertainment for the poor man. Mm. It's poor man's entertainment. That may be, but when you took out Anthony Wiener, what was interesting about him, because his whole platform was, you know, kind of a middle class and helping the middle classes of America. Middle class of America, I think, perhaps also code for the working classes. But at any rate, it was trying to help the man in the street get by. And I think that was such a strong message. And so at one point in the documentary, you're really kind of rooting for him because he seems like he sincerely believes this. But what gets in the way is his inability. So he's a sexting, texting addict. That's what he is.
Right.
You know, and he never seemed to be able to get past it, even though he had to resign as a congressman.
And if I remember correctly, he had to go for rehab for that as well, I believe.
Yeah, he might have. That's not I don't remember that being in the documentary. But the point really is, why exposing yourself? And he's asked that question in the documentary. He says, well, I hope that my entire life isn't reduced to this one moment. I want you to show me as a full human being.
Well, but I think at the same time also, I think the demands of the audience as well, whether they're able to make that distinction between the person as opposed to the person that's being portrayed via this documentary, right? Because these two are obviously very public figures. Now, perhaps they're able to form a better context around these individuals, as opposed to just that sexting and escapade. But then, that's ideal thinking, isn't it? Because Bill Clinton, for example, after 8 years in office, he's still just synonymous with being impeached for the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Yeah, so Roger Stone is important because he wrote that book during the last presidential campaign talking about Bill Clinton. He was the one who put out the message that Bill Clinton raped the women. Mm. He had... So what's interesting about him is that he didn't get out into the cold because of his sleazeball politics and political strategies. He was out in the cold because he had a sexual scandal. So I'm very intrigued by Americans who allow just about everything. But when it comes to sex, they're so puritanical. And, for instance, would Emmanuel Macron win in America because he married his teacher, so many years older than himself? Would Americans deal with that?
Well, I bet the late night talk show hosts will have a fun time with that.
Yeah, because they had no problem with Melania Trump being 24 years younger than Donald.
Yeah, totally. And they're going to town on Donald Trump, So I think it's, again, a confluence of not just this idea of, wanting to be, showcasing yourself, and these lack of inhibitions, relative to, say, again, our society. But I think it's also what the American audience, generally speaking, demands.
Okay,
and they're basically just catering to it, eh?
We're coming up to the news, but before that, we have Sing by Travis, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad, and with me, Han. And we have more on the morning run, because we start this morning with the devastating news of that bomb in Jakarta targeting police officers, yet more in that running global theme of terrorist attacks. We, of course, have developments in the Philippines where, martial law has been declared in the island of Mindanao, one of the two largest islands of the Philippines. Also, developments in Britain there with the attack in Manchester. Now, of course, Han, with so many people having to experience this and experience this as almost a daily fact of life, I think psychologists are very interested in how to deal with the trauma that results from it.
And this appears to be a new normal, right? Now very often the Western world, doesn't get fazed when there's news of an explosion or a bomb attack in the Middle East, right? But now that the tables are turned, how do the various segments of society then come to terms with what seems to be the new normal? Because it's not just Manchester, it's Brussels, it was Paris, it was Nice, and then here,
or Jakarta, yeah, or Marawi City, right?
Exactly, and so here, even in our part of the world as well, right? Do we have to start coming to terms or getting accustomed almost, if I may use that word, to this new norm, and that new norm being the heightened level or the increased frequency of these terrorist attacks?
So BFM spoke to Dr. Roxanne Cohen-Silver. She's a professor of psychology and social behavior, medicine and public health at the University of California, Irvine, to talk about how you might discuss the issue of terror attacks with your children. And this is what she said.
We find that how parents react to these kinds of events spill over to their children. So children don't see these, don't experience these kinds of events in a vacuum. It really depends on the age. After the 9/11 attacks, I had two children that were one in elementary school, one in high school, and I felt it very important that they understand that the events had occurred. I didn't feel that there was any way that they would be shielded from that information, but it must be age appropriate. So if a child is in preschool, one would certainly say something different than if they were in high school. I don't think that one should assume that children are not going to hear about these events in school, on the playground, or with other people. But I certainly would strongly encourage parents to ensure to the best of their ability that their children are not watching videos and repeatedly being exposed to graphic images. I would very much monitor the exposure to images of a disaster or a terrorist attack on the computer, on Facebook, in social media, on television. I, as a parent, would very much want to pay attention to the amount of media to which my children were exposed.
That was Dr. Roxanne Cohen-Silva. She's a professor of psychology and social behavior at the University of California, Irvine. Han, you and I, neither of us are reproductive, at least at this point in our lives. But I know you have students and you teach. Does this question of terror and terror attacks and people being murdered ever come up in class?
Oh, certainly, you know, because when we study sociology, which is one of the classes I tutor, for example, you know, we have to talk about how, you know, different perspectives and different ideologies view crime, for example, or what deviance is. You know? So, but then, to be fair, my students are older. You know, they are in their teens. You know, so they perhaps have a better, you know, context to understand these what's happening around the world.
I don't know that. So, does context help a lesson or mitigate the fear that might be generated from this?
Well, at least according to Dr. Roxanne, she's saying that there should be an age-appropriate message. I couldn't help but think that this is, you know, well, at least for the Western world, you know, they still have this luxury of still being able to hold on to this notion of a protected childhood, that they have the luxury of sending out age-appropriate messages. As compared to, you know, kids in the Middle East or, you know, kids who are in these hotspots, they don't get an age-appropriate message. They just see their family members and friends just getting blown up. You know, so, like, again, it still has that hint of privilege, you know, just hearing what Dr. Roxanne... I mean, and it's not to say that she's wrong. You know, I'm just pointing out that, you know, perhaps she comes from a privileged position.
Also, I think when you talk of Malaysia, when not in those conflict zones, but still, because you're exposed on a daily basis to the horror, you could still be affected, even though, you know, no one directly is involved in those events. We'll be back with more, a quick roundup of the business news coming up for the rest of the day. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Tan Chung Han, and joining us, Kusu Chuang, with a roundup of the business stories that are going to be animating our discussion from now till 10 a.m.
Yeah, so when the news comes, it's like rain. When it rains, it pours, yeah? So a couple of global business news. Starting with the fact that Moody's, for the first time in 30 years, cut China's credit rating. So what it means is now China is rated below Estonia, Qatar, and South Korea, and on par with Slovakia and Japan. And the reason that they've downgraded China's debt for the first time in three decades is basically a reflection of China's huge debt issues and its ability or otherwise to finance that debt.
I think it would be interesting this is interesting because despite the rhetoric and the sentiment from the Chinese authorities, from the regulators, you know, basically trying to stem those credit risks, yet in the eyes of sovereign credit ratings agencies like Moody's, they're saying, nope, no go, we're still going to downgrade you.
Is there a political question here? Is Moody's a political instrument?
Exactly. So that's the thing, right? So, you know, it wasn't that long ago that Nazir Raza of CIMB at the time, he said that, you know, at some point in time in the future, Asia has got to come up with its own credit ratings agency, because not only was the Moody's, S&P and Fitch triumvirate quite slow in calling debt ratings lower in the global financial crisis, it also has certain political dimensions because they are Western companies and they were slow to downgrade Italy and America and the UK at the time, but they downgraded Asian countries. You see, so there's a little bit of that lingering stigma going on.
Moving on, Geely and Proton, we had a suspension of DRB HICOM's shares yesterday, anticipating some big announcement, and there's a lot of speculation. I know you both were speculating very heavily. So now we know.
The fat lady
has sung. What is the score?
Aretha Franklin is in the house, yo. So basically what happens is the Chinese, contrary to reports, have only taken 49.9% in Proton. The Malaysian interest via DRB HICOM and Syed Mokhtar retained 51%, but they've sold Lotus in its entirety to outside interest. But 49% of Lotus remains in Malaysian hands in the form of Syed Mokhtar's personal vehicle.
Yeah, and I think also a key message that was communicated during the press conference yesterday was that Proton remains a national car maker. I know we have got severe doubts and criticisms against that statement, but nevertheless, in their eyes, Proton remains a national car maker. And another positive out of this is that Proton gets to maintain those tens of thousands of jobs, tens of thousands of Malaysians who are reliant on Proton.
Which in a way is still true, because the thing is with Mr. Lee Fu Shu, the individual that owns Geely, he allowed Volvo's interest status as a national Swedish car maker to continue, and it still continues to be badged as Volvo. So yeah, he allows that, and of course there's always brand equity involved with the brand.
Okay, we'll be expanding on those stories later in the morning. We also have CIMB first quarter results. Net profits up 1.18 billion ringgit.
So that's a 45% bounce on a year-on-year basis. Consumer banking, which is usually the mainstay for most financial services, was only up by half a percentage point. But the real kicker came on the wholesale banking side, so things like treasury income, things like corporate banking. But the deal flow on IB, which is basically your IPO mandates, were quite thin. So a lot of stuff on the Forex trading desk.
Oh, we're coming up to the top of the news, but before that, we'll have some ads. But this is Counting Crows and Accidentally in Love, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.